Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation recorded live during the May 2023 Youth Education Conference held in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
So entrepreneurship, you guys, that's what we're talking about today. Who knows a little bit about entrepreneurs? Do we have anybody who has businesses already, entrepreneurs in the house? Yes, I love it. Anybody who wants to be an entrepreneur, show me your hands. Okay? Anybody who's here just because this was the thing, the mom made you? Anybody mom made you? Hey, got some mom made yous. Very honest, thank you. All right, well, anyway, so thank you guys for being here. Today, we're going to be talking about entrepreneurship, which I think is amazing. And the way this is going to go is, I want to first explain why I think entrepreneurship is so important. How many times have you guys heard this weekend that you guys are growing up in an interesting, crazy, difficult time? Four, five, six times? Okay. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today. And then for the end of the discussion, I want to share with you some things that I think you can be doing right now to become better entrepreneurs and to really be successful as an entrepreneur. And here's the cool thing, even if you don't plan on being an entrepreneur, these things will help you in your life. So that's kind of the way it's going to go today. Hey, we have a presentation. Give it up for our help. Okay, so to start, I want to share a story with you guys. The story of Michaela Ulmer. Anybody know Michaela Ulmer or heard this story before? Okay, so sometimes when I teach kids about entrepreneurship, they say, oh, we're too young. Or and even parents and adults sometimes say, well, kids shouldn't be entrepreneurs, let them be kids, etc. So I want to share Michaela's story because it's so amazing. So Michaela Ulmer was in, she grew up in Austin, Texas, when she was 4 years old. So just a little, no, there's no four-year-olds in here, right? Like, this is a little kid. Her mom entered her into a competition. It was an entrepreneur competition where they had to show up at like a fair or a craft fair and they had to sell something. And whoever sold the most would win the competition. So Michaela, a few weeks before this, she'd been outside playing and a bee had stung her. And we all know how awful that can be. And she was really upset about it. She took care of it with her mom. The next day she goes out to play and guess what happens again? Another bee stings her. So she gets stung by a bee again. So at this point, she's very furious with bees. And but her mom starts to teach her about bees and how important they are to our ecosystem. And she's kind of interested in bees. Well, a couple days before it's time to go to the fair, she's like, I don't know. Her mom's like, we're going to do this. And I mean, she's four. She's not understanding all of this. But they talked about what they could sell. And they decide to sell lemonade. But Michaela's idea was, well, I don't want to use sugar in my lemonade. I want to use the honey from the bees because she'd been learning about bees for a couple weeks. And so they made a lemonade with honey, and it was infused with, I don't remember, some sort of a mint or something like that. One of these, you know, you guys have seen these lemonades that are infused with other things. So it was one of those. Anyway, so she shows up at the fair, and I mean, we're talking about her, so no surprise she wins, right? She wins the competition. Well, now she kind of likes it, so she starts... she starts going to a lot of these different things and she starts selling a lot of lemonade. So she'll show up at the farmer's market. She sells her, she called it Me and the Bees Lemonade. So it was this special lemonade with honey and starts selling a whole bunch of it. So you fast forward a couple of years and she's selling so much lemonade that they decide, well, we probably should put this in a bottle and start selling it like bulk. So they start bottling it up and now it has a label on it and she starts doing that. So she was four when this all started. When she was 9 years old, so just 5 years later, Whole Foods, the supermarket, you know, the big, huge supermarket, came to Michaela and said, we want you to put your lemonade in our stores. And so she signed a deal with Whole Foods when she was nine for $11 million to sell her lemonade in Whole Foods. And to this day, you can find her lemonade in there. And now she's out. She's teaching kids about entrepreneurship. She's done a couple of other really cool ventures. But a huge, huge successful story, right? Like $11 million at 9 years old. That's pretty awesome. So Michaela is this awesome entrepreneur. And you guys, you can be doing this right now. If a four-year-old can start something and turn it into that, then you guys can be doing this as well. You are not too young. Sometimes we have this picture of an entrepreneur of being somebody special, somebody different, somebody who has really great and unique ideas. Well, that's not true. And as we talk about this today, I want you guys to recognize that every single one of you, regardless of whether you're a people person, not a people person, whether you're engineering-minded, not engineering-minded, whatever, you can be an entrepreneur. It's just you have to decide you want to do that, and you have to put effort into it. There's a lot of learning, and there's a lot of ups and downs that go with that. But you guys can do it if you want to, okay? So if anything else you take out of this conversation today, please know that you guys can do it if you want to, all right? So let's jump in of why I think entrepreneurship is so important. Oops, I'm going the wrong direction, though. Let's go this way. Okay. It's interesting if we go back in time. So if we go back before the Industrial Revolution, so you guys have probably all learned about the Industrial Revolution and how amazing it was. If you go pre-Industrial Revolution, everybody was an entrepreneur. If you think about it, you walk into a village at that time in the 1700s, and what did you find? Who were the entrepreneurs? Yeah, like, so you're walking down, oh, the baker, well, he's an entrepreneur, he has a bakery. Down the street, you've got the candlestick maker. Okay, he's, even the farmers, all of them. Who else?
The butcher.
The butcher. That, we finished the story for me. Thank you. Butcher, baker, candlestick maker. So all of them were entrepreneurs. Along comes the Industrial Revolution and says, you know what, entrepreneurship is risky. You know, if the crop doesn't go well on the farm, then your family's going to suffer, which was true. And they said, why don't we start making factories? Everybody come work in the factories. And it changed the way that we did things. Now, there were still entrepreneurs, but we didn't need as many entrepreneurs. When the Industrial Revolution came along, instead of entrepreneurship, what did we need?
Workers.
Workers, right? So we need people to come to the factory and start to work. So instead of teaching people how to be entrepreneurial, how to take risks, we started teaching people how to be safe. And so our education system and all that we taught became very much how do we create good workers that will come to the factory and work for us and, you know, spend their lives there, and then we'll take care of them. And that was the promise of the factory life. You don't have to worry about risk. If it doesn't go well, the owner takes it upon themselves, and we'll just pay you. You come to work, and everything will be good. Well, so we kind of move forward, and we move through different revolutions. So we had the steam revolution, then we had the electricity revolution, and things changed a little bit. Well, in the 90s, 80s and 90s, we had another revolution where we started computing, the computing revolution. And that was kind of my era. It was a time when knowledge became very, very valuable. So prior to that, hard work, if you could work hard and put time in the factory, that was what was valuable. In my generation, it became very valuable to know things. So we went to school and we got an education and we went into college and we became engineers and doctors and lawyers. And if you knew something, if you had knowledge, then you were paid very well because you had. So when I first started my career, I was paid well because, you know, I went to engineering because I knew how to do certain calculations and how to figure things out. And so because of that, you know, they paid me good money to do that. Well, guys, you are part of another revolution. So there's another revolution happening, which you're probably all very aware of, right? So now we're into the fourth industrial revolution, which we call the intelligence revolution. The intelligence revolution is what's happening to you. It surrounds what's happening within artificial intelligence, within robotics, and within automation, okay? How many of you guys have heard of artificial intelligence, at least heard of AI? Anyone not heard of AI before? Who could explain AI to me? Do you guys know how it works? Maybe a little bit? Okay, I'm not going to explain how it works, but I want to talk about how artificial intelligence is going to affect your lives. So, first and foremost, remember what I told you, what was valuable in the computing revolution?
Knowledge,
knowing things. You guys are growing up in a time where knowing things is not valuable. Why is that?
What?
Because the computer knows everything, right? So I remember there was a time people would ask me a question, and if I didn't really know the answer, I could kind of make up and they're like, oh, okay, I believe you. Now what happens when I do that? I say something, they look it up, they're like, no, that's not right. No, that's not what Google says, right? So the knowledge is just not valuable anymore. Did you have a comment here? Right, and we'll look at that today just a little bit. So we live in a time, you guys, and so knowledge is not valuable. But education has always been surrounding learning knowledge, right? So there's this discrepancy between what we're educating people with, knowledge, and what is actually valuable. So if knowledge isn't valuable in this revolution, then what is valuable? Well, what's valuable when I hire somebody? I don't need them to be able to look on Google to find out information. What I need them to be able to do is use information to solve problems, to use information to be creative, to create new things. That is going to be the currency of the future. Because in a world where artificial intelligence, where robotics, where Google, where knowledge is so cheap and so easy, you guys are not going to be getting paid to know something. If you know what year the revolution was, that's awesome, but you're not going to make money knowing that. You're going to make money knowing what happened in the revolution, understanding the principles that occurred, and then being able to apply that to something new and different. That's what you'll get paid to do. Okay, so that's the world that you're growing up in. And it's crazy. How many of you guys have used... So when I started talking about AI like 8 years ago, and I did a presentation, and I would talk about how... So just a couple of examples. I would talk about lawyers. Lawyers, we've always thought, make really good money, right? Well, lawyers right now, we have way, way too many lawyers because we already have artificially intelligent lawyers. We have a system where you can literally sit down, type in what's happening in the case that you're working on, and the AI will tell you exactly how to proceed in that case. So we don't need young lawyers coming out of school anymore because we have AI that takes their place. Now, we still need some lawyers, but we don't need as many lawyers. And so what's happening is these lawyers, people going to law school right now, they're going in, they're getting $200,000 and $300,000 of debt. They're coming out of law school, and guess what their starting salary is? About $40,000 for a lot of them. Because and it used to be a couple $100,000. And so it made sense to get the debt. Well, now they're making $40,000. You'll make more going out and welding than you will as a lawyer. And so it's changing, right? Now, I'm not telling you, don't walk out here and be like, Mom, Nephi told me we don't need lawyers. I'm not going to be a lawyer. Now, that's not it at all. We will still need some of them. We just don't need as many. And things are changing. And what the lawyers will do is absolutely changing 100%. I like to talk about these jobs as the jobs that grandma loves, right? If grandma, she's always like, oh, my grandson is a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer, right? So yeah, let's talk about doctors. Doctors, I work in the medical field. You guys, I have watched robots do surgeries, the whole thing. I've watched, they bring the person in, they put them on the table, they prep them, and then they bring the robot in and they push a button, and then the doctor walks away. Now, they still do it with a doctor in the other room, but the doctor doesn't do anything. The robot comes in, it cuts the person open, it takes out what's bad, it puts in what needs to be replaced, and it sews it all up, and it does the whole entire procedure by itself. That's the world you guys are growing up in. We don't need as many doctors as we used to, and we won't in the future. Engineers, what do engineers do? I'm an engineer by trade. Engineers take big data sets, and they look at all the information, and they figure out how to solve a problem. Well, guess what AI does really well? They look at information and they solve problems. So we're not going to need as many engineers, right? What about computer programming? Have you guys heard we need to learn how to code? Anybody know how to code? Guess who the best coders in the world are right now?
Robots.
AI, right? It's AI. So we're living in a world. Did you have a comment back here?
Oftentimes the AI still needs an actual programmer to supervise in the case that it does make a mistake,
yep,
which happens often.
So he makes a good comment. So right now the state of the technology is that it still needs some oversight. It still makes some mistakes. But do we think that's going to be happening forever? Probably not, right? It's going to change.
The world is constantly evolving.
So you guys are growing up in a world that is very, very different. So AI, has anybody used DALL-E before? How many DALL-E users? So this is an AI. So you guys see down below, I was writing a children's book and I didn't want to get an illustrator. So I thought I'll use AI this time. And so I went in and I typed in this prompt. It said, I need a childlike wombat and his animal friends setting up a lemonade stand. I want it to be a cartoon, 4K, and very colorful. The AI, within about 30 seconds, returned this picture for me. Completely new, completely novel, never been seen before. That's the picture it gave me for my book.
Wow.
So I could create my whole book without needing an illustrator just by going in and typing these prompts into DALL-E. What's that? I'm working on it. I'm not done with it. Go ahead. That's pretty good, right? It's better than I can do for sure. But that's what the AI was returning for me. Let's look at another one before we go there. Has anybody used ChatGPT?
Yep.
So I had ChatGPT set up on my computer. I was just going to do something with you real quick. I was going to ask you guys for a prompt. tell me something that you want it to do. I was going to type it in and have ChatGPT do it for us. I can't even say the word. Yes?
So he was talking about how a lot of times you need people to check that. So there's different levels of ChatGPT. Right now we're on ChatGPT-4.
Yep.
Which ChatGPT-4 and 5 eliminate the problem of needing it corrects itself. And it's actually kind of scary because it can predict the future now. Like, pretty accurately, at least the fifth one. That's why Elon Musk doesn't want the fifth one to be made. Anyway, but
yeah. So
very quickly.
We're grown up in this world, so I could just show you guys really quickly. You guys could give me a prompt. So I told it recently, act like you're a children's author that wrote a book about Wally the Wombat and his lemonade stand, and give me a pitch that you could use for a publisher. And I typed that in, and ChatGPT, within about 30 seconds, wrote me an entire pitch of what I could say to a publisher to promote the book that I was creating. Now, there was some editing and some things that I wanted to add to that, but you guys are growing up in a world that's just very, very different, okay? And I want you to recognize that. And some of you guys probably know that, but here's the thing. You guys are kind of standing here. Here is the reality, okay? And I don't want anybody walking out here like, oh my gosh, Nephi told us the world's going to end. That's not it at all. But we are looking at a very real situation where in the future, when you guys graduate from high school, when you're college students, and when you're raising your families, we do not know, and if anybody tells you that they do know, they're wrong. We do not know what jobs will be available. We don't know what will be valuable and what won't be valuable in terms of what you're doing. We live in a very real world where the future is very, very unknown, unlike it has been any time in the past. It's changing so very fast. And so if you're in a world where you don't know where the future is, how do you prepare? That's the big question. I mean, if you don't have that question, that should be your question. What should you guys be doing right now to prepare for a world that we just don't know what it's going to look like? Right? That should be like the biggest question on your mind, because you guys have to make decisions very soon about what type of career you want to pursue. That's always been the decision we make at the age of 18, 19. Where do you want to go to school? Do you want to go to college? Do you not want to go to college? Should you go out and be a welder instead? Like, all of these questions are going to be questions you guys have to face in the very, very near future. But here's the problem. We don't know. We really, really don't know. And that makes it very difficult. Okay, so what does this have to do with entrepreneurship? That's the question today. In a world where we don't know what it's going to look like, here are the things that you guys need to be able to do. Okay, I don't know what college degree you should get or if you should get a college degree. I honestly don't know the answer to that. But here's what I know you absolutely must be able to do. Number one, you must be able to learn really, really quickly and really efficiently. Being able to learn is going to be one of the greatest skill sets in your lives. So what does that mean? It means it's not just like if I have a book that tells me exactly what problem set to do and it tells me exactly what to do. That's not the kind of learning you guys need. That's knowledge learning. You guys need to be able to say, you know, be able to look at something and be like, wow, I see a problem there. I don't know how to solve that. I'm going to have to learn some things in order to solve that problem. And you're going to have to go out and do research. You're going to have to learn how to use artificial intelligence. You have to learn how to use all of these tools that you have to figure things out. You have to know how to learn. Not just going through the rote memorization and the math books and writing papers. You need to know how to learn. Okay? Number two, you have to be able to know how to solve problems. You've got to be able to look at something that you don't know the answer to and figure out how to solve it. And I'm not just talking about solving math problems. That, again, that's just, math problems are easy because there's a right way to do it. I'm talking about solving problems that you don't know the right way, and there might not be a right way. You got to go out and figure out what you think the right answer to that is and try it. Number three, you guys have to be able to turn and look at things quickly. You got to be able to, like, so you guys might end up, okay, I'm going to go to college. And as you're going to college, you're like, wow, this, I don't know if what I'm doing right now is going to lead to something I want. You're going to have to be able to pivot. And you make decisions of, like, that's not going to serve me in the future. I'm going to have to pivot another direction. So right now, on average, people are changing careers, like going from being an engineer to an accountant every 7 years, which is really, really fast. They're changing jobs about every 2.5 years. You guys will probably change careers about every 4 years, 3 to 4 years. It's going to be happening that fast. And when you change careers, when you go from being an engineer to accountant, there's a whole bunch of learning that's going to be occurring. Now, here's the cool point for you guys. You guys are homeschoolers. You guys are set up to do this, right? I'm very worried about people in the public education system because they don't have the flexibility that you guys do. You guys can right now learn how to do these things. But you gotta figure it out. You gotta start doing it. You gotta focus a little bit less on memorization, a little bit less on just doing math problems, and a whole lot more on how to solve problems and how to do hard things. And entrepreneurship is one of the greatest teaching tools that you could possibly have to do that. If you want to learn how to solve problems, try to start a business to solve a problem. It's hard, and it takes a lot of effort, and it's not easy, and you're going to go through a lot of learning, all right? If you want to know how to go out and learn quickly, entrepreneurship. If you want to learn how to pivot quickly, if you go out and you're trying to create a product and people don't like your product, guess what you have to do? You got to pivot. Oh, let's do it. Let's do something different. Let's do this. Businesses are all over the place all the time. So it's such an amazing teaching tool. It's one of the greatest tools you guys have at your disposal right now while you're young to learn these critical lessons that you're going to need in the future. So I think everyone in this room should at least have, you should no fewer than one or two businesses before you leave your house. But ideally, you've started three or four or five. Because most likely you're going to fail in those, and you got to pick yourself up and try again and try again and try again until you find something that works. So entrepreneurship is an incredible tool to prepare you guys for a future that you don't know what it's going to look like. What I know we will always need in our world, as long as the robots don't take over, what we will always need is people that know how to create new things and how to be innovative and how to use the technology and the tools at their disposal to do great new things. And entrepreneurship will prepare you for that right now. Okay? Any questions about what we've talked about so far? Anybody like overwhelmed by what we talked about so far? A little bit? That's okay if you are. Yes, right here.
So my dad has like six different ideas for something he could sell, right?
Yep.
But then he doesn't have, like, he said he's not good at the part of the, okay, so these are like the six or seven problems I have. How do I build this? How do I fix that? This. He's an ideas guy.
Uh-huh. So what does he do next?
How do I get to the other side of it as well?
Yep. So that's a great, there's a lot of people that I know, so I'll be out talking to people and I say, oh, what do you want to do? What's your future? And they're like, oh, I'm an entrepreneur. I want to be an entrepreneur. And I'll be like, okay, what are you doing? And I'm like, well, I'm not doing anything yet, but I have these ideas. Okay, so those are people that I call on this, and don't take this as a negative thing. Don't be offended by this. I call them wantrepreneurs, right? Because they want to be entrepreneurs, but they're not entrepreneurs. Because what does an entrepreneur do? They do. They take some risks. So I would answer that question. I would say, if you don't know exactly what the answer is, you probably know what the next step is. Take the next step. Try to do it. Then take the next step. And if it's wrong, what do? We pivot, right? And we go and do something else. We change it. So an entrepreneur is somebody who doesn't sit and be a wantrepreneur. They're not like, well, I don't know exactly what I want to do. Or here's the other one I hear all the time. Well, I want to be an entrepreneur, but I want it to be like this thing that I love, and it's just perfect, and it like aligns with me personally and spiritually, right? And they sit there like, I'm waiting. Just give me what it is, right? It's never going to happen, guys. Sometimes you got to just get up and go get started. And then eventually you might find something that you're just passionate about and you love. And you might not. You might just make a whole bunch of money doing something else, and guess what you get to do with that money? Go and do the things that you love, right? So there's nothing wrong with that either.
How can we balance our school and education life with trying to be active and starting a business?
So I would say incorporate as much as your school and education life into the entrepreneurship experience as you possibly can. So when you're doing entrepreneurship, guess what you learn? You learn math, right? You can do an entire math curriculum within your entrepreneurship experience. You learn economics. You can mark off your economics credit if you need that. You can write. You're going to have to learn how to write sales pitches and do those types of things. Guess what? You can mark that off. You can make that as your writing segment. So there's a lot of that education that can be put into the entrepreneurship that's going to be really, really valuable as well. Now, how do you balance it? It's a difficult question, right? It depends on how deep you get into the entrepreneurship and how passionate you are about that. Because it's going to be driven more by your interest than it is by, well, I'm only going to put 3 hours into this and 3 hours into this. Here's what will happen if you find something you really love and you're passionate about in entrepreneurship. You're going to be like, okay, I'm going to stay up from like 8 o'clock at night until my mom makes me go to bed because this is awesome. And then I'll do what you need to do tomorrow, but I'm going to get back to it as soon as I possibly can. And it becomes this good cycle. It's a great question though. All right, so are we all in agreement? Can at least agree that entrepreneurship is powerful, that it's a good thing for you guys, that all of us probably need to be trying it a little bit? Can we agree to that? Okay, let's move on. I want to teach you guys some things, some principles, some ideas, and some thought processes that are going to help you guys be awesome entrepreneurs. Okay, so let's get into that. We'll skip this portion about time. All right, so here's the first thing. Rubik's Cubes. So when I was a kid, anybody like Rubik's Cubes? Anybody have a speed cube? Some speed cubers in here? Okay, when I was a kid, you know, the Rubik's Cube barely came out, and they were just this anomaly to me, right? I could solve a Rubik's Cube, but it involved removing stickers and, like, putting them on another place, and I could solve every Rubik's Cube there was. But an actual Rubik's Cube, I had no idea how to do it. Now, those of you who know how to solve a Rubik's Cube, you know that there are specific moves that move certain colors and squares in certain orientations to the right place. And if you do those moves in a certain order, then you're going to get a solved Rubik's Cube. But here's the thing. For you speed cubers, you guys, do you ever have, when you pick up a Rubik's Cube, is it ever the exact same puzzle as one you've done before? No. I mean, the statistical probability of that is so small. Every single time you pick up a Rubik's Cube, even if you know what moves to make, is going to be completely different than the last time you picked up a Rubik's Cube. Here's why this is an important concept. As you go into the entrepreneurship world, I have so many kids come up and tell me, and so many adults as well, not just kids, I should say, and they say, Nephi, I want to be an entrepreneur. Tell me exactly what to do. And I don't know if you guys have seen this in your Facebook feed or in your Instagram posts and everything, but there are a lot of people out there that are promoting, like, I made $1 million and I want to teach you how to make $1 million. Just do exactly what I did. It's everywhere. There are so many people out there. Guess what? If you guys see that, run from it. Because entrepreneurship is like a Rubik's Cube. There are no two companies that, you cannot follow what somebody else has done exactly and have the same success. If Elon Musk, the guy who created Tesla and now owns Twitter, if he was alive right now and he tried to start Tesla and he did exactly the same things today that he did years ago when he started Tesla, he would be an absolute failure. It wouldn't work because he lives in a different time, a different era. There are different factors involved. It's completely different. So the Rubik's Cube, you guys, entrepreneurship, it's not going to be the same. I want to teach you guys a few things. I want to teach you the moves to make, but you're going to have to do the Rubik's Cube yourself. And it's never going to be easy, and it's always going to be a lot of trial and error. Okay? So just expect that as you get into entrepreneurship. Let's skip this one for today. All right, so some principles. Let's talk about some principles. Number one, failure. The word failure, what does the word failure mean to you guys? What does failure mean to you guys?
Screwed up, didn't work.
Messed up, didn't work. What else? Yes?
Doing something that didn't succeed.
Yeah. And oftentimes failure looks like we do our very best. Like we put our heart and soul into something and it doesn't work out the way we want it to.
Not how to do it.
Another way, I like that. I really like that definition. Yes?
Well, Albert Einstein once said that if you haven't made any mistakes, you haven't ever tried.
Absolutely. Love that. Yes.
Opportunity to try again.
Here's the reality, you guys. And I want you to, don't raise your hands, but I want you to think really in your mind. When is the last time that you put your heart and soul into something? You did your very, very, very best, and it turned out an absolute disaster of a failure. Okay? Do you want to share one? Or do you just, you've had one recently?
Brownies.
What's that?
Last time
you made brownies. Love it, love it. Did you have one you wanted to share?
Yeah, it's just, it was more of like a project. I was really young at the time, and it was totally should have failed. So I wasn't surprised, was then, but not now. Like,
As you look back, you're like, yeah, I probably should have failed. Okay, you guys, here's the reality. You are not failing enough in your lives. You are not failing enough in your lives. Because for most of us, as you look at your past, you're like, yeah, I kind of had that little thing, like the brownies, like I messed up on the brownies. But have you had like a disastrous, awful failure? Now, I'm not talking about moral, ethical failures. I'm not talking about like I did this huge sin. Like that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something you wanted to accomplish, you put your heart and your soul into it, and it didn't work out. Trying to get scholarships, okay? Put your heart and soul into it. Didn't work out the way you wanted. Okay? So that's a good one. I like that. But you're not having enough failures. And what that tells me is that as a group, and I'll admit, I haven't had enough failures recently either. As a group, we are not stretching ourselves enough. We're not pushing ourselves to our limit enough. Let me tell you a quick story. So my daughter, Melina, she's 8. She is like the most tenacious little 8-year-old in the world. And it was actually last year now. I was going to say a few weeks ago, but it's been months. We went to a pool, and at the pool, it had one of those climbing walls that goes out over the water. Have you guys done these before? They're awesome. You'd climb up the wall, and if you slip and you fall, you just fall into the water. So my daughter, she was 7 at the time. So we get there, and she really, really wanted to climb this climbing wall. I mean, to the point where so she spent 3 hours as a 7-year-old, climbing on this climbing wall and just climbing and falling and climbing and falling. And she was nowhere close to the top. And we're getting ready to go. I'm like, Melina, we got to go. It's time to go. And she said, oh, just one more time, Dad. And she goes over and she's like, I'm going to get this. And she climbs and she falls. Boom, splashes in the water. So we get home. And on Sunday nights, you guys, what we do in our family is we have tried to create a culture in our family where successful failures are a regular part of our discussion. So Sunday night, here's what we did. We got together and we talked about what was the good this week, what happened. Anybody else have good Sunday night dinners where you talk about good things? Yeah, that's awesome. But one thing we incorporated was we said, now what was everybody's failures this week? And then so we talk about our failures. And guess what we do when someone says their failure? We clap. We're like, nice failure, nice job, that was awesome. So Melina on Sunday, she's like, she had ear-to-ear grin. She's like, Dad, dude, I totally failed on that climbing wall. It was awful. I was nowhere near the top. And we all clap. We're like, nice job, Melina. Great failure. And she's just ear-to-ear grin. Now, it was a failure. She tried as hard as she possibly could, and she could not accomplish what she wanted to accomplish. Total failure. But she was excited about it. It was a great thing for her. She learned from it. It was an experience that she was excited about. Well, we went to the pool a few weeks later. Now, sometimes failure makes us not want to do something. Guess where Melina was? She was on the climbing wall. And she spent 3 more hours on the climbing wall. And at the end of that night, Melina made it to the top of the climbing wall. And it was awesome. And she was so excited because she had learned from her failure. It was okay to fail, but she wanted to keep trying. And she tried again, and she tried different ways. And she pivoted, and she did it a different way, and she was able to accomplish it. She falls to the bottom. She's ear-to-ear grin. We talk about it. She's like, Dad, I did it. And we're all excited for her. And then she looks at the climbing wall, and there's another route that's harder. And she's like, all right. And she just jumps back up, and she starts the next route. Okay, so that's a successful failure. That's what successful failure looks like. And you guys, in your families and in your lives, you need a culture of successful failure where you put your heart and your soul into it, it doesn't work, and you get lauded and praised for that. That should be something that we're excited about because that means we have an opportunity to learn from it and change and do something different. To be an entrepreneur and just in life in general, you guys have to be willing to fail. And you need to be able to do a whole bunch of it. And if you don't have any good failures recently, you're probably not pushing yourselves to your limits, which means you need to look for ways that you could possibly fail. And I know some of you guys. I had a girl a few years ago. I talked about it. She came up to me afterwards. She said, Nephi, I'm not trying to be proud about this, but everything I try, it's usually pretty successful. She's a really talented young woman. And I know some of you guys are like that. And I said, well, and we started digging and found out that there are a couple of things. Like she was a little bit afraid of talking to people. And I'm like, all right, there it is. That's what we're going to look at. And so we focused on that. And she had some amazing failures talking to people. They were funny and embarrassing, but they were great failures. And she learned from that and grew from that. You guys need to be failing more. Society tells us that failure is a bad word. We've tried to remove it from everything, But it's the exact opposite in reality. Failure can be the very great, greatest teacher you have. So look for something that you guys can fail in really, really spectacularly. Fail more. Okay? All right, let's move on. Oh, I like this one. How much time do we got? Oh, not enough. Okay, let's talk about this. So in science, has anybody ever done a research study and you collected data and tried to fit lines to it? Anybody? Any scientists in here? Okay. So in research, we collect information and we want to be able to put lines through it, because if you can put a line through it, it means you can predict something using that data. So in science and engineering, it's a great tool that gives us, so if I'm making something and I want it to be a specific size, then I set, you know, the size it should be, and I give a little bit of tolerance for, you know, manufacturing error. And then I measure it, and if I find that something's really out of size, then I can do something to the machine to correct it, to make sure I'm making parts that are correct. So it's a great tool to tell me that things are happening. But oftentimes in science, you see those two data points up there to the side? We call those outliers. And outliers are data points that we don't like as scientists. And what we oftentimes do in science is we find these outliers and we're like, ah, man, maybe my instrument wasn't working that day. Or maybe this thing, like, we try to find reasons to throw out that data because it makes our line look awful. And we don't like that as scientists. We try to get rid of it. Unfortunately, one of the worst things we ever did was try to apply these scientific techniques to human behavior. Because averages are really, really good ways of describing part size and how machines work and that kind of stuff. They are really, really awful at describing how humans behave and how humans work. You guys, there is no average. There is no normal when it comes to human behavior. And yet we act like there is. What's that?
The average person won't rob a bank.
Right. So here's one simple example of this. Have you guys ever seen a brain scan? Do you know what I'm talking about? So brain scans, they use imaging to map out how our brains work. And it's really cool. We've gotten to a point where you can hook up a brain scan to somebody, and then you can ask them to do certain tasks, and they can measure and see how your brain is, like, activating to do that task. So they do these big studies, and they look at a whole bunch of people doing the same activity over and over and over. And then they take that data, and they create what they call the average brain. And they say, okay, when somebody's picking up something from the ground, these are the parts of the brain that activate. And they have this average brain. Here's the big secret behind brain scans. If you took every single brain scan in that study, and you compared it to the average brain, guess how many of those brains would look like the average brain?
Zero.
Not one. Zero. Zero brains would look like the average brain. And in fact, if I had a brain that was lighting up like here and here, I might have brains that are lining up like way over here and way up here. Something completely different doing the exact same task. And yet I say, oh, the average brain lights up here and here. So if you light up here and here, you're an outlier. You're weird. You're different. But that's not true. Right? In human behavior, average, there is no average. And so here's the point of this, you guys. Can we all just agree that we're weird? We're just a little weird. Do we all have just a little weirdness? Now, we're homeschoolers, so we're weird already. You're totally normal. He is the average man. We have the average man, people, ladies and gentlemen. No, but we are all a little bit weird. We all have these data points. Here's the worst thing you could possibly do. If you want to be a good entrepreneur and you want to change the world, if you have an outlier, do not get rid of it. Outliers make us unique. Outliers give us opportunity to make differences and changes that we couldn't make otherwise. Don't try to force yourselves or your friends to be the average, to be normal, because that eliminates, nothing interesting happens on the average. The only place where interesting things happen is in the outlier. Allow your outlier to be there, okay? Now, to be clear here, I want to give one caveat. Obviously, if there are mental struggles, if there are things that, like, antisocial behaviors, negative behaviors, that's not what I'm talking about when I talk about outliers, right? What I'm talking about in outliers, or maybe you're just like super, super Like, you just don't give in to anybody, and you're not going to give in to anybody, and you're like stubborn as can be. Now, your parents hate that. They want to try to get rid of that, right? But that could be an incredible benefit to you as you move forward in your life. So don't get rid of it. Steer into it. Be stubborn about certain things. Now, don't tell your parents I told you that, because they're going to kill me for that. But steer into your weirdness, you guys. Be okay with it. Make that part of you, okay? That's where all the interesting things happen. Oh, this is a good one. What do we got after that? I forget. Let's see. Let's stop at this one for a minute. Okay. All right. So this is a picture of a spook house. And anybody like spook houses? Like, are you guys big spook house people? Okay, this is like the perfect image of fear, right? People are just terrified. So years ago, I was in Utah. There's an amusement park called Lagoon. And I grew up in Utah. And so we went to Lagoon one time. I was probably 14. My older brother was about 15 and a half, 16 years old. And we were like walking around Lagoon, having a great time. We're going on all the roller coasters, doing all the stuff. But we were at that age where we thought we were really, really cool. Now, we weren't really, really cool, but we thought we were really, really cool. And so we go, and there's this spook house. Now, as a 14, 15, 16-year-old boy, spook houses shouldn't be a problem, right? Like, you should be able to walk into a spook house and walk out without it. So we walk into the spook house being like, dude, we're awesome. There's nothing in here that's going to scare us. And we start walking through the spook house. Now, it's a kind of a normal, regular spook house, and we're going through, and something would pop up, and we'd be like, huh. And we walk on, you know, and another thing, but that's stupid, you know. Like, and we're just like these 14, 15-year-old kids, right? And so we walk through, and we're just so cool, and we're awesome. And we get done with the whole thing. We're like, yeah, that was dumb. And my brother's like, yeah, that was dumb. And I'm about this way. At the end of the spook house, there's a door. It's kind of where you're sitting, and there's a hallway. And I'm about to it. And everything's light. Like, the spook house is over, right? So we're walking out. Well, that was dumb. And there's the door. And we're all cool and like, spook houses don't scare us. And then all of a sudden from behind me, I hear a noise. And it sounds like this. Boom. I'm like, boom. Boom. And then, boom. Like, and we turn around. And there's like this 8-foot dude with a mask. And he's got this giant chainsaw. And he is chasing us. He's coming right at us down the hall. Now, we're cool, but we're not that cool. And so we're like, there was a scream. Now, I don't think it was me. I don't think it was me. I think it was my brother. But it was loud, and it was very, very high-pitched. And there was falling and stumbling and crawling and screaming as this giant chainsaw massacre dude is chasing us out of the spook house. And we get to the door. We stumble out the door. We're like rolling over. Somebody's still screaming. I don't think it was me, but somebody was still screaming. And we get outside, and we're like, the door closes, and the guy, I could literally hear the guy laughing inside. Like, he's laughing at us. Like, it was so, he got us so good, and we were so scared, and my heart's pounding, and eventually the scream stops, and my eyes open, and I wish that was the end of the story, you guys. I really, really wish that was the end of the story. We're sitting outside now in Lagoon, having come out, stumbling out of a spook house, screaming bloody murder, terrified. We're there. I open my eyes and we look up. And I'm not kidding. The timing could not have been worse. 8 beautiful, tall, 16-year-old girls are walking by right there. And we look up and we were not cool. We were the guys on the ground screaming. And they are laughing their heads off at us. I mean, they're just laughing like crazy. And they turn like we... It was the most embarrassing. To this, there's nothing you can say, right? You can't be like, there was a, you know, there's nothing. You just lay there knowing that you are the laughingstock of all of Lagoon. And so, but here's, you guys, fear, we all have fears, right? Fear is a natural reaction. It's something that, you know, if you look at, if you think of evolution, told us that when something scary comes, when an 8-foot guy with a chainsaw comes, now he was probably like 5'5", but he seemed like he was 8 foot. When something comes at you, you run away, you get scared. That's a totally natural reaction. But guys, fears will prevent us from accomplishing great things. What prevents us from having good failures? It's fear. What prevents us from stretching ourselves and pushing into new endeavors? It's fear. What makes us a wantrepreneur and not an entrepreneur? It's fear. Fear prevents us from being able to do the things that we actually want to do. We're just afraid of it. We can't let fear drive and guide our lives, you guys. Now, my oldest daughter, she's 16 now. When she was 13, 14, she was mortified, terrified of making a phone call. Any other phone call fearful individuals in here? Like, I would say, Zoe, go make a phone call. And she would, like, melt on the floor. She'd be like, no, Dad, no. And she would be there like, I don't want to make a phone call. I'm like, Zoe, just make the phone call. No, please don't make me make a phone call. It was crazy. Now, you guys feel, you guys, some of you guys know what I'm talking about, right? So we have these fears. Now, to be a good entrepreneur, does my daughter need to make phone calls? Yeah. To be successful in life, does she need to make phone calls? Yeah. She has to overcome her fear. Let me give you guys, with my last couple minutes here, a process to overcome some of your fears. I call it the step-up challenge. Here's what the step-up challenge is. Do you have a comment or a question?
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
It's fear itself. That's right.
Or death. In public speaking.
Here's the step-up challenge, you guys. If you want to overcome a fear, let's say it's calling somebody on the phone. Okay, let's just take that for example. What is the easiest thing you could possibly do that would be a little harder than what you do right now? Give me something that you could, like, one tiny little step up. What's something you could do that would be just a little bit hard, but it would be more than you're doing right now? Any ideas?
Practice with your parents over the phone.
Okay, so you could call your parents. Okay, so on my step up challenge, I would put call my parents as the first challenge. Okay, then I would do that. What would be the next step? Call a friend, or maybe call grandma and grandpa, maybe even less stressful, right? So call grandma and grandpa. Call a friend. Call an uncle, someone you might not talk with very often. But here's the point. You step up the challenge, and then you call your parents, your friend's house, and talk to their parents, not them, right? Then you call somebody else. So you just step up one step at a time and face that fear one step at a time. And what's at the top rung? You make a phone call that you're really terrified of making. Now, here's the key. If you're going to do the step-up challenge, you've got to give yourself a reward for making it to the top rung. So my daughter, we started out, did that process, and we said, when you make that phone call, then we'll go out to dinner together. And that was the reward that she got. And so she did it. She stepped up. And I would love to say that now she has no fear of phone calls. That's not true. She's still a little afraid of it. But she makes phone calls now when she needs to, and she doesn't melt. She might whimper a little bit, but she's better than she was. So we can step up and face our fears. You guys, I hope today you walk out of here wanting to be an entrepreneur, not a wantrepreneur, willing to take those challenges and facing these things together. Fail more, face your fears, go out and do it. Thank you guys for your attention today. Appreciate it.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this record. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.